Hello and welcome to The Investment Hour, our new format for the weekly Investors Chronicle podcast. For our regular listeners, don't worry, we'll be keeping all the usual good companies and market stuff, but adding much, much more. This week's big topic shows exactly why we wanted to expand away from just companies and markets.
The record low price of oil that you've been seeing, it's at a level that's very interesting to a lot of people.
Yes, thank you, Donald Trump, for those pearls of wisdom. It has indeed been a big week for oil. I'm John Heumann, and this week I'm going to be talking to Neil Wilson about why the price of oil did this, and Michael Taylor about what he did about it.
The price of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate, which is the benchmark for US oil, today traded as low as minus $40 a barrel.
And I'm Megan Boxall, and I'll be talking to the IC's commodities expert, Alex Hamer, about what that means for the London listed companies in the sector.
I spoke to a CEO today who said that in Aberdeen, you just see the rigs coming in. You know, they're shutting down for safety reasons to stop workers getting sick. They're shutting down because they're looking at more expensive production and they're cutting that. You know, they're cutting down on maintenance work. There's a lot of, you know, changes happening in North Sea.
And we've spoken to regular IC Pod interviewee Phil Oakley about MoneySupermarket.com, a company which has confirmed its dividend and is looking reassuringly solid.
Lots of things going on here. Most of it, I think, reasonably positive.
The Investment Hour. 60 minutes of money with the Investors Chronicle.
But before we get into all of that, John, there's something that's really got your back up this week. Company fundraisings.
Yes, indeed. And I've had a big rant about this in my editorial. Lots of companies have been raising money, unsurprisingly, to help them fend off the worst effects of COVID. But they've been doing it in such a way that's really been quite bad news for private investors. There used to be a rule in place under preemption rights that meant a company could only raise 10% of its capital, its outstanding share capital, without going back to its existing shareholders. The authorities, the powers that be, have allowed that amount to be doubled to 20%. And companies are taking full advantage of this and in some cases offering heavily discounted placings to a select group of institutional investors. And obviously this is very, very bad news for private shareholders who face massive dilution as a result. There's a bit of a campaign going. I signed an open letter this week to those authorities to do something about this. The FCA amongst them, you know, their job is to protect private investors from things like this, and they seem to have endorsed it. So yeah, I don't think it's very good at all. Lots of people are very unhappy about this.
Yeah, I mean, hardly surprising. But then, obviously, the alternative is companies going bust. So there's got to be fundraisings, or at least in some sort of help somehow.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's disputing the fact that companies need to raise money. I think they're just disputing the means by which they do that, because those means mean that a portion of the shareholder base, and that portion is the retail shareholder base, are being massively disadvantaged in these circumstances. And there are alternatives. There are technology alternatives. A company called Primary Bid, whose chief operating officer is in fact someone I used to work with in the city many, many years ago, have a platform which allows private investors to participate in these things if anyone would use it. So, you know, there is a request to companies, get involved with this company and keep your retail shareholders on side. They are very important. They are very engaged. They are a group of shareholders who are very important for the market as a whole and the health of the market and price discovery. I really think it's symptomatic of the way that private investors are actually treated, which I would say is very badly overall. And I think that the time has come for something to be done about it.
Well, I mean, coronavirus is showing up. It's now the time to do a lot of stuff about a lot of industries, and that's something that we may explore in podcasts to come.
I think we'll be exploring that a lot.
This week, oil is the big story, and you've spoken to Neil Wilson, who luckily, or perhaps mystically, wrote the cover feature about oil this week, even before the price had crashed. Let's listen to what Neil had to say.
So welcome to Neil Wilson. How are you doing, Neil?
Hi. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's been a busy week, but I'm sitting in my home office study and just looking out the window waiting for a beer delivery to arrive. So it's all good.
Nice. It has been a busy week. We kind of spoke a few weeks ago when we were discussing potential things to write about, and oil came up and we went for it, and the timing has proved spectacularly good.
It has, yeah. I mean, the sort of what's happened in the oil markets over the last few days has been utterly unprecedented. Just to sort of recap, I guess, on Monday, the front month WTI, that's West Texas Intermediate, the US contract for oil, dropped for the first time ever into negative territory. So people were paying to get the oil taken away from them. It was unprecedented, partly just to do with market technicalities, because WTI is a physical contract. So if you're holding that contract at expiry, then you have to take delivery of that oil and you need to find somewhere to put it. And normally, of course, what happens is people are just rolling these contracts into the future months. But because of the coronavirus and the lockdown, and partly because OPEC had been pumping so aggressively at the start of the year, the tanks are getting full. There's nowhere to put the oil. No one's using up any refined products. The jets, you know, the airlines are all not moving. No one's driving. So there's nowhere to put the oil. And at that point, you get this very unusual position where people are being paid to take the oil.
I mean, is there no storage at all?
There is some. I think there is a bit in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in the US. They've got four sort of cave systems, which they can fill up a bit more. But and Donald Trump has talked about buying 75 million barrels. That will help. It would help if it happens. And whilst it's maybe not full, it's sort of fully leased. So we think that probably. The sort of Cushing hub in Oklahoma, where all the WTI goes to, is pretty much going to be full by sort of mid-May. And the problem for WTI, and this is why, you know, Brent prices, which is international benchmark, Brent is what we produce in the North Sea and in the Middle East, that was not nearly so badly affected, just because it's a seaborne commodity. You can get it out to many more places. It takes a long time to travel in the tankers, so there's a sort of extra capacity at sea. You can rent more tankers to fill up. Whereas WTI is essentially a landlocked commodity. You can't really get it out anywhere else. So you need to store it in these tanks at Cushing, Oklahoma, and a couple other places. So, it's going to be tough, I think, over the next few weeks, because the storage constraints are not going to get any better, and I don't think the demand side is ready to pick up just yet.
Should we talk about demand? Because there's some interesting charts that you've put in your feature that really, you know, hit home how serious this situation is in terms of the kind of lack of consumption that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean the demand for gasoline in the US has collapsed. The demand for jet fuels collapsed. The demand in April for all oil is down about 30% from last year. Which is a phenomenal amount of oil. It's sort of 30 million barrels per day of oil. And it's expected to improve, but slowly. And it's just the case that if no one's driving anywhere or flying anywhere, there's just not the pickup. And gasoline in the US, so for example, just to sort of show how much the US is a driver of this. 10 million barrels per day which is a tenth of global demand or global supply traditionally is just for auto use, just for people driving in the US, and that is a tenth of all the oil used up every day in the world. So hence why if you see that sort of level of lockdown that we're seeing, that has a very, very sharp and immediate effect on oil demand.
And at the same time, you've got a chart on the first page of the feature looking at US fuel production, which is at a record level. So not only have you had this massive slump in demand, but you've also got some pretty, pretty serious production coming into the market as well.
Yeah, so we have had, I think at the very edge of that chart, it sort of drops off a cliff basically very, very quickly. So I think you are actually seeing the it had been hitting a record high of 13 million barrels per day, I think, for the US, just above that, coming into this sort of twin supply and demand shock. And it's now drastically fallen back already. And I think it's going to continue to fall back over the coming weeks as we see more sort of shut-ins. And I think that's the point. We've dealt with a twin supply and demand shock. It's demand shock from coronavirus. And on the supply side, US oil has been increasing in output. We've had more production, record production from Brazil last year, Norway increasing production, and then OPEC back in March, their deal with Russia unraveled and they sparked a price war and flooded the market. So you had this massive double shock, and that's why the oil market at the moment is so precarious.
Well, that's something you've been looking at in your daily market outlooks that you write for us, the ongoing sort of geopolitics behind this. You talk about shutdowns of some of the production in the US, but I think you mentioned in the feature that that's not actually quite as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, it depends very much on the field in question, but essentially it's not just a case of turning the tap off. It can require a lot of money to mothball, and then a lot of extra money to then get it going again. I think particularly in Russia, that's a problem with their fields. But I think it's much easier in Saudi Arabia. I think they're much more able to sort of turn it off and on at will, and they've always been the swing producer. US is not quite that easy with the shale fields. So I think what it means is that producers have not been able to just say, "Yeah, we'll turn the pipes off, no problem," just to help the situation. And then what it means is that with prices so low and you get forced shut-ins of oil production, it might not be economic to reopen. So we could see abandoned assets, supply being lost permanently, and of course that has a knock-on to the financial sector with Wall Street. The big banks on Wall Street on the hook for around about $200 billion worth of loans to the US energy sector. So it has repercussions for the wider financial markets.
Are we seeing signs that that's filtering through into the wider market?
Not yet. We're still looking pretty good. I mean, up to sort of 30% off the lows still for the S&P. And I don't think you're seeing that much stress yet. I think with the efforts of the Federal Reserve and the stimulus that's coming through to support the banking sector, there's a sense that maybe they're not going to face the same problems as they have done maybe say in 2008. So even if they do chalk up some pretty monumental losses on these loans, basically the Fed's got their backs.
Yeah, I mean, one thing it does suggest that, you know, if there is a significant cut to production, that actually that might support the oil price in the future, and that's something that I think you wanted to pull out in the feature, is like where does the price go from here? What are we looking at?
Yeah, I think by the end of the year, there's a few banks putting out forecasts as they do all the time. I think you'd be looking towards $50 a barrel perhaps by the end of the year again, as supply comes out and as OPEC OPEC and Russia, remember, have fully committed to these production cuts, which are quite drastic, and they're going to run through till 2022, April of 2 years hence. So there is production coming off. I think there's a potential for a spike if you see supply being damaged, if supply gets damaged a lot worse than expected, then you could see a spike in the oil price in say sort of 2021 there or thereabouts. But it remains a bit of guesswork, just simply because we don't know what the demand will be, because we're still not out of the woods in terms of the coronavirus and the lockdowns and the economic damage that's being felt. So the demand side is really the main unknown right now.
Have you seen anyone brave enough to try and estimate when we might see some bounce back in demand?
Well, I think Goldman today just put out a note saying they think the demand in May will be down 18 million barrels per day for oil. So that's an improvement from 29.7 million barrels per day in April. So they're sort of suggesting that we will get a pickup in demand as early as May. But in terms of the global economy, I mean, I don't think anyone knows what the outlook is. There could be permanent changes to behavior, permanent loss of demand in areas like jet fuel because of people flying a lot less. But then on the other side of the coin, if they're enforcing social distancing measures and you have to leave this is just an example. I'm just sort of choosing this as an example, but you know, you have to leave the middle aisle of the middle seat of the airplane empty, then you need more then you need effectively, you need more planes to fly in order to carry the same number of passengers that you used to carry. And so demand could find a boost from that side of things. So it's a lot of uncertainty there.
Indeed. I mean, you also mentioned in the feature Tesla and potentially, you know, the coming electric vehicle revolution as being another factor that could destroy a bit of demand as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I try and make the point in the piece that sort of that this comes at quite an important moment in the structural shift as companies move away from hydrocarbons, governments try and move away from hydrocarbons. Saudi Arabia, the whole idea behind floating Aramco last year is to wean itself away from oil dependency by 2030. That down the line, I think down the line, you know, oil will be worth nothing. The last barrel of oil that's produced will be worth nothing because there won't be any use for it. But that's a long way off, a very long way off. And if anything, then cheap oil right now just makes it even harder to wean ourselves off. You actually need a high price of oil to help pay for the kind of adjustments and the investment in green technology that these companies like Shell and BP want to make because they know the way things are going. But they need positive cash flow from selling oil in order to fund that, and if you just have cheap oil, then it's going to be a lot tougher to do that.
Indeed, you mentioned BP in the piece and its aspirations to be carbon neutral. I actually really like the well, I'm quoting you here. It's oil that will pay for the shift from oil. In terms of the kind of the short term outlook, I know this was the negative oil price was a technical factor based on futures contracts. Could we see a repeat in the months ahead? Given that, you know, demand isn't likely to bounce back and those contracts still work in the same way?
Yeah, and the short answer is yes. I think the June WTI contract could become very shaky towards expiry because I think there's still the same sort of players in the market. It may be quite inexperienced players who could get caught the wrong side of that particular trade and then be trying to offload the contract towards expiry and then finding no bid. And if there's no bid, the only bid's going to come from the physical people who can take physical delivery. And if they're not wanting any, then you could see the same problems. I think with Brent, it should be a bit easier. We've got the expiry coming up on our particular platform. It's going to roll on Friday. I think that in theory could suffer some problems, but it's cash settled, not physically settled, so it should not experience the same kind of stresses in the sort of functioning of the market.
Yeah, I mean, there is an interesting sort of side effect to all this is that you have oil exchange traded funds or ETCs that obviously are based on the futures contracts. That we're seeing a little bit of damage there. I mean, what are you seeing on the trading desk, Neil?
Well, we're seeing very high volumes in oil futures. I know the CME Group experienced its busiest day ever for the June contract. There's 2 million futures contracts traded on our platform. It's very, very, very high volume as well. I think, you know, the problem, and this is a sort of comment on the nature of trading and the retail traders is trying to always catch the falling knife and trying to guess where the bottom's hit and people can get caught the wrong side of that. But that said, we have actually on the sort of Thursday, we have seen a bit more stability coming back into the oil market. So those that were trying to call the bottom sort of on Tuesday probably made at least in the last day or so. I don't want to jinx it, but they have made a decent call there because it has the June contracts have rallied off their lows.
But it sounds like there's plenty of scope to be caught out in the future.
Always.
Yeah, definitely a market to be very careful of, I would suggest. Thank you very much, Neil. That's absolutely fantastic. It's a really great read, as I say, brilliantly timed. Why were we talking about oil? It was the geopolitics stuff that prompted us to look at this in the first place.
Probably putting the world to rights in a pub somewhere back when they were open.
Yeah, well, one day. Well, enjoy your beer delivery when it turns up, Neil. What have you got coming?
I've got some from local Marlow Brewery, Rebellion Brewery. Some nice light ale.
Fantastic. Actually, on that note, I'm going to give a plug to my local brewery who I'll be dropping out later. The Malden Brewing Company, Puck's Folly. It's fantastic stuff. Thanks, Neil. Speak soon.
Thank you. Cheers, John.
So we've heard what the oil market has done and some of the technical reasons why the oil price turned negative this week. But what does this all mean for the companies that that are trading on the London market, many of which our listeners and our readers will be invested in? Alex Hame has got some thoughts there.
Hi, Alex. Yeah, I mean, I guess over to you. What's the situation? What does it mean? What have we seen from UK listed company share prices this week as the oil price has collapsed?
It's been interesting. There's when the oil price went, or part of the oil price went negative on Monday, there was a pretty strong reaction downwards for listed oil companies, basically 10% drops. But remember, this is after a month of them bouncing around after the big 9th of March collapse. So it's not unexpected. And actually, if you look at the big UK oil and gas companies like Tullow, Premier, they actually bounced back a day or two later when people realised that they were not dealing in WTI contracts at all. So there's a little bit of, you know, quick reaction and then people have relaxed a little bit.
Explain that. So obviously WTI, the US benchmark. So what's happening, that price is quite a US situation. So Petrofac, where are they operating? What impact does that crash have, if any, on them?
It's a really interesting example because Petrofac is a Middle East focused infrastructure and services company. So they pick up big contracts to build and maintain rigs, refineries in some cases. So the really big infrastructure that oil companies rely on. And a few weeks ago, they already announced that they were going to change their spending this year significantly. So they've cancelled a 25-cent dividend. They want to cut capital spending by 40%. And then reduce further costs by $100 million. Since then, and we can see, you know, the prudency of those decisions by them losing a $1.5 billion contract in one of the Gulf states, one of the Emirates. It was building a massive gas plant, and they've cancelled that now. So that's immediately a significant chunk off their order book. So it's pretty serious for the services companies. You know, Petrofac is in an advantage position because it's in the Middle East. You look at companies like Hunting, exposed to onshore US, they're really going to struggle. They already had a tough year last year. There's Hunting, you know, Wood Group is also exposed there. So the services companies are really having to make big cuts in terms of workforce, unfortunately, in terms of expansion spending, because there's, you know, no one wants it anymore. And anything, so a lot of them actually have their own technology, so that kind of spending's gone as well. Beyond the services companies, I mean, they're kind of one block in this pyramid. You've got companies like Tullow. They're also trying to work out how best to keep cash on the books because it's heavily indebted. They want to save $1 billion, or they want to gain $1 billion this year, and they've just sold an asset they have on the books for 800 and something million. They've sold that for 575. Just to kind of get some cash flowing, and there's still some roadblocks to them getting that money, but these companies are really scrambling for cash.
So obviously, cash is something that a lot of companies are worried about at the moment. But then when you combine it with this madness in the oil price, obviously it's worrying. But how about the London listed drillers, most of which are North Sea drillers rather than US onshore, which is what the negative price was related to, the US onshore. So what's the outlook like now for the Shells and BPs of this world?
Yeah, I think you know, Shell and BP have a good amount of production coming out of the North Sea. They're fairly balanced, so they have gas as well. Their revenue is going to fall a fair bit this year because people just aren't buying petrol. So that hits their retail, well, it hits the whole chain. So it hits retail, it hits refining, it hits production. But I think the ones that we'll see the most kind of action out of are the North Sea independents. So, you know, I spoke to a CEO today who said that in Aberdeen, you just see the rigs coming in. You know, they're shutting down for safety reasons to stop workers getting sick. They're shutting down because they, you know, they're looking at more expensive production and they're cutting that. You know, they're cutting down on maintenance work. There's a lot of, you know, changes happening in North Sea. So the CEO I spoke to was from Serica, and that's an interesting story because they're 80% gas, And while gas prices are low, they've just brought in a dividend, which is, you know, we've just talked about all these companies cutting dividends, they're cutting spending, they're making massive changes. And Serica, because of its gas and specific company position where they've just had their full year of bigger production, they're bringing in this payout. And they reckon that if they lose production for 3 months and gas falls further, they can still afford that 3p dividend. So the North Sea is kind of a really interesting place to look at the moment, because the heavily indebted companies are struggling, but also you've got gas players who are actually not that much worse off right now.
So the headlines, obviously, oil price turns negative. It isn't actually a calamity for the whole industry.
It is serious because, you know, while WTI May contracts went negative and June is not looking great, that kind of negative impact, negative perception of oil as a commodity means that Brent has also come down, and it recovered a bit today. I think it's at about $25. But for example, we look at a company like EnQuest, and they said they were trying to reassure investors, I think last week, that their cash flow breakeven is $33 per barrel of oil equivalent. I say equivalent because they have some gas production as well. You know, for this year, they say that they can get to a $25 cash flow breakeven, but even that looks a bit optimistic with the current Brent price. So, you know, things are changing very quickly, and you know, we've had a few weeks of oil companies scrambling to work out what they're going to do for the rest of the year, and you know, who knows what's going to happen next week.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. Everything is moving so quickly. It's hard to keep up sometimes. If you had one pick in the sector, have you got a company that you think looks in a better position than anyone else?
I think look at gas. Mm. Some of these companies might have 80% gas, 20% oil. So there is, you know, if oil miraculously comes back, they do have some exposure to that that climbing. You know, even companies that are valued on their future production. So someone like Energean, they're valued basically on their exposure to, they've got two gas fields where supply is already contracted to Israel and the gas plants are being built. So this company is valued on future production, which means at the moment they're not that fussed and their share price has stayed fairly strong. Even onshore US diversified gas and oil, they've spent, you know, into the billions this past few years buying up assets in the Appalachian Basin, so not the Permian where everyone's going under at the moment, but the Appalachian Basin. And they're doing fine as well because once again, their portfolio is gas. So those two companies are interesting to look at. Out of the two, diversified gas and oil is the one with the actual revenue at the moment. So and they maintain their dividend and have done a buyback program as well. So they're the ones actually doing okay. Who knows if that's going to continue over the next few months, but they've certainly put out strong statements about continuing payouts and staying strong and even buying up more assets this year. So I think investors should have a look at those two.
Awesome. Okay, good note to end on. Thanks very much, Alex.
Thank you.
Investment.
There is one group that will be enjoying the volatile conditions of the market right now, and that is traders. So we've spoken to our very own trader, Michael Taylor, to see how he is taking advantage of the mayhem.
How are you doing, Michael?
I'm good, thanks, John. How are you?
I'm okay. You've written about Shell in your column this week. That's a bit outside your sort of size bracket usually, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But with stocks moving, huge volatility, it's good to trade these stocks because you can get in and out very easy. There's not any liquidity issues. You can buy and sell as much as you want. You're not going to make a dent in Shell's price, which is nice. And it's moved huge amounts over the past few weeks. I mean, the other day it was up 20% in a single day. How often do you see anything like that? I mean, I'll be telling my grandkids about that one day, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, you don't see it on a mega cap. Are you avoiding some of the small cap stuff then for sort of liquidity reasons?
Well, it's just if you can get the volatility in the larger stuff, why not trade the larger stuff? And it just makes more sense. The spreads are narrower. The set's traded, so you can get in on the bid with direct market access. and you don't have to deal with the market makers, which is nice.
So what's the attraction of Shell? I mean, why Shell not BP? Before we come on to the actual trade you're looking at.
That's a good question. I think probably because I haven't looked at the BP chart. So I tend to follow a couple of them. But Shell, I think the attraction is bigger. And when it went down to, I think it was just under 900 pence the other week, that sort of confirms a bottom. So now we've got a point to trade off. And I think I mentioned this in the article this week. There's a chart there. A lot of traders now are going to be looking at that as the bottom. So they'll be eyeballing that and they'll be putting bids in and looking to get long because we've got that previous support point, whereas before it was just falling and falling and nobody really knew how far it could fall. So we had people saying this is opportunity of the decade at like 1,400 pence and then it fell another 500 pence to 900. So you never really know how far these things can fall. It's the old catch a falling knife comes to mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the trade you're looking at now? What's interesting you about Shell at this point?
So it's up today. It's up to about 1,400. But if it gets to around 900, I'd be looking to take a long position because you can get in, you can get out very easily. And I think that's a good risk to reward because if you've got the support, as I say, people look at that. And who knows what can happen. I mean, we had the May futures expiring Tuesday, negative prices for the first time in history for delivery of oil. So who knows what can happen over the next few weeks, but it's quite fun to watch. Obviously, if you're on the wrong side of the position, it's not very fun at all. But to spectate, it's quite amazing.
So you're waiting for it to come back again, then, essentially, before taking a long trade?
Yeah, I don't really want to get long here because I don't think the risk-reward is in my favour, and that's really what I care about. I mean, if Shell could be 20 quid, and I think if the risk-to-reward was in my favour, I'd take it. I don't really have a problem with buying higher or shorting lower. It's all about the risk-to-reward and the chart pattern.
What are you worried about? What are the risks you're worried about with the price at this level?
Oh, it's just purely the pattern. There's not really any support or resistance to trade from. It's in the middle of a range. I mean, there's not really any point for me to buy or sell.
What about oil itself? I mean, are you looking at... would you trade the underlying commodity or is that something you would steer clear of?
I steer clear of it. It's not my area of expertise, so I just leave it. I follow oil just because of oil stocks. So it sort of gives me an idea of what's actually happening. But I never trade it. I don't trade any commodities. I don't trade Forex. I don't trade Bitcoin or anything like that. Purely UK stocks.
Yeah, absolutely. So apart from Shell, are you looking, casting your eye across the hydrocarbon complex for other opportunities?
It's on my list of things to do, the never-ending list of things to do.
But Michael, you're stuck at home. That never-ending list to do should be getting shorter and shorter and shorter right now.
Well, sadly not. No, I've been given jobs by the boss, unfortunately. as well as trading throughout the day and looking through charts on a night, yeah, I've been hoovering and stuff, painting the back wall.
sounds fun. Should we talk quickly about Blue Prism, which you wrote about in your column last week? Talk us through what you were describing in the magazine last week and kind of what's happened since.
Yeah, so I was looking at the price, looked like it was about to start trending downwards, and I think it was a point around £10. There's a big support line there and another one at £8. So there would have been the opportunity to get short around 10, traded downwards to around 8 and then double up. But my thought was that they would need to do a placing at some point because if you look at the cash flow of operations, they were burning so much. And I did think that in this market, it would probably be good to get it done sooner rather than later. And that's exactly what they've done this week with an ABB. Pretty good price, to be fair. 4.5% discount, 100 million. For a company that's making no money, it's a fairly good raise. I'm quite impressed. But yeah, for me, that takes it off the short list for now. Might come back onto the radar again, but for now, it's done.
So you didn't get the trade on then on that one then?
I didn't get the trade on. It didn't come towards my entry. So I missed it, unfortunately. But yeah, there's always other stocks, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot of places coming up, I expect. I mean, there is an interesting lesson there, though, that, you know, that you had a plan and stuck to it.
Yeah, I think discipline is key. If you're going to trade, then ideally you want to take the best setups as possible. What you don't want to do is get the fear of missing out, where you see a rise in stock, everyone piles on, only for the bid to collapse and you're left holding the baby. So you want to be buying at the ideal points continuously. And that's why I said earlier, the price doesn't really matter. You've just got to have a plan and you've got to know what you want to see and then do your best to trade it. And if it doesn't work out, if you don't get the trade on or you haven't lost any money, and you just look for the next one.
Thank you very much, Michael. Good chatting to you. We'll have to chat again soon.
Indeed. Thank you, John. Take care.
You too. See you later. Investment. No doubt investors will be looking for some oases of calm in these crazy markets. And we've spoken to Phil Oakley to see if he has any ideas where they may find it.
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm all right, Megan. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. So you've written about a positive company story this week. Company whose dividend you're confident will be sustained, which is nice in the current environment. Money Supermarket, what's going on there?
It's something I've never looked at before, but it sort of ticks a lot of boxes in terms of being highly profitable, generates lots of cash. And I just wanted to have a deeper dive into the actual business and find out how it makes its money and what's really behind the numbers.
Yeah, so let's start with that. So obviously, people will have seen Money Supermarket. A lot of people will have used Money Supermarket. But how does it actually make money?
Yeah, I'm essentially, the business model is quite simple. It's a middleman. And so what goes on is that when the customer comes to the Money Supermarket website, types in their details, it hopefully finds the right product for them. Now, once found the right product, if they then click on a link and enter their details, that's when Money Supermarket can go to an insurance company or an energy company and say, hey, I've just found you a customer, pay me some commission. And that's essentially how Money Supermarket makes money.
Yeah, which is actually an interesting point in terms of the business model. Obviously, yeah, it is so reliant on what's going on elsewhere. So when there's the energy price cap has a big influence on how much revenue it makes from people switching any energy suppliers every year. And then it also is reliant on people actually completing. So how's it coping with coronavirus, with what's going on at the moment?
Not bad, I think, is the answer, because it's dealing in products that we all need, regardless of what's going on. You know, we all need house insurance, and people still need gas and electricity and broadband and all these other kinds of things. What they don't need as much is travel insurance, package holidays, car rental. What's not doing as well for them is things like credit card switching, personal loans, because banks are getting a bit nervous now. They're starting to think that perhaps lending money in the current environment is not a good thing. Very simple sort of rule for this business is if prices are rising, so if insurance prices are rising and energy bills are rising, you get more switching. If you look at the insurance side of it, which is half its revenue, that's still going great because car insurance premiums and home insurance premiums are going up, so people want to switch. And the energy side, which is the next biggest, is also doing quite well as well. And so it's holding up pretty well. This is pretty resilient business. And you can see that because they feel confident that they can pay their dividend to shareholders. And we've seen, obviously, recently, lots of companies coming out and saying, look, we're not confident about how our finances are going to look, and so we're going to have to not pay the dividend. We have to hold on to the cash. Money Supermarket said, no, we're okay. You know, we've got plenty of cash. The business is doing quite nicely, and we can pay the dividend, which is a big tick in the box.
Yeah, absolutely. And that does, I mean, doesn't just read into the operations. It's actually the way it's been managed, the way it manages its cash, how profitable it is. Its numbers are all they're all pretty nice, and you've obviously looked into that a lot, your speciality. So what sort of profit numbers are we seeing? What are the things that you like about Money Supermarket's figures?
Well, if I look at three things in figures, really. So I look at profit margin, so how profitable its sales are, how much of its sales it turns into profit. I then look at return on investment, or return on capital employed, which is the profit, the operating profit and the trading profit as a percentage of the money invested in the business. And then I'll look at the ability to turn the profits into cash or free cash flow. And then I spend a lot of time looking at things like free cash flow margin. So you look at free cash flow as a percentage of revenue. So from, you know, this is a business that's making, 30% profit margin, high 40s return on investment, and free cash flow margin of about 25%. There are not many businesses on the UK stock market that can do that and can do that consistently. If you then join that up with a reasonable view of the business that you think that they can grow or keep growing, then you have the basis of a pretty good investment, because you can keep throwing off those profits, that cash, and that can get paid back to investors. I mean, one of the interesting things about this business is that you lay down the IT system, pay the staff to maintain them and keep them working nicely, then you actually don't have to spend that much more money. And that is the kind of characteristic that you think, hey, I quite like that as a business. And a lot of the costs are also quite fixed. I mean, the marketing revenue part of it is a massive chunk of it. But you can argue that they have to spend that because this business is so much about branding and awareness. But, you know, once you've covered those costs, each extra pound of sales that you get just basically drops straight through to profits. And so the bigger that gets, the more profitable the business gets. And that's what's been going on.
I mean, it certainly ticks the boxes. And the fact that it's now confirmed its dividend is very nice for investors who may be worried about the state of other companies at the moment. But obviously, investors have realised that Money Supermarket is holding up better than others. Its share price is only down 10% year to date, which is not nearly as bad as the wider market is. Do you think that the general turbulence in the markets may mean it will come off more in the coming weeks and months?
Difficult to say. Depends what happens. I mean, I think if the current levels of uncertainty stay with us, and that's my view, that this is not going to get fixed quickly, then I think a business which has seemed to be pretty resilient is still going to, and also paying a dividend, is probably going to be still quite likeable. Mm-hmm. I think you could argue if we get a situation where things open up again and people get a bit more confident, they might switch out of a business like this into something that's more cyclical and can benefit from an increase in economic activity. Yeah, that's possible too. But I think this is the kind of business that, you know, if you look at businesses that have done well for the last decade, they have been businesses that people can believe in, that stick with through thick and thin. And I think the characteristics of this business are, you know, they've not changed.
Mm-hmm. And what's the long-term outlook for this sort of market? Obviously, it's really crowded, which is why it's having to spend so much on marketing. Could this, in the long term, the challenges that everyone's facing, actually thin out that market a bit and make the long term look even more attractive for the? I mean, it is one of the two biggest players in the price comparison space.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where I think, you know, if you ask me where I've got a concern about this business, it's its ability to grow, because the market is pretty mature. And as you say, it's pretty crowded and saturated. So I think There's certain things that it can do to take a bigger slice of the market. There are certain parts of the market where you think there's still capability to grow, certain parts of the insurance market, other kinds of products. I think the travel side of it is quite interesting. When the travel market comes back, I think there's more to go for there. But I think, I mean, they're saying that they think, the market has been growing. You know, they've got 13 million customers last year. So it is something that is accepted. And I think if we, you know, get into an economy that where money is tight, then, you know, you think, well, maybe this is something that can benefit. So they're saying they think the market can grow maybe 5% a year for the next few years. We'll see. But I think there's things that they can do which can get more people to go to their website. So they're spending a lot of time making the website easier to use. The other thing that they're doing is trying to make the mobile phone use of this service a lot easier. And particularly when I say easier, the ability to actually buy something on it. Because what tends to be happening is that people look at it on an app and then they don't go and transact. That's the experience.
Yeah, it is not quick enough, and your commute's over, and then you don't complete the transaction. And especially if that consumer has entered the Money Supermarket site through a Google ad, Money Supermarket will have paid for the Google ad, and then they won't have actually made any money from that customer, which, yeah, is obviously problematic. So, yeah, tech is definitely seems to be something that they're really working on. But as you say, growth in such a saturated market is never going to be straightforward.
No, I mean, I think there's other things they're doing as well. They're trying to make it more personalised as well. You know, they're trying to get people to actually log into a site and stay logged in. And I think they've got about 600,000 users now that are having their energy bills, their credit to rating, or credit score, sorry, being monitored on a day-to-day basis. And then it then offers products that become more attractive on the basis of that. So this is a kind of a change from sort of not just being a comparison site, but also being a monitoring site. And a lot of this comes down to the success of this or otherwise is going to come down to trust. You know, how will customers trust giving their information over to Money Supermarket or Money Supermarket's computers? I mean, people are happy to do it to Google every day. But it's obviously, well, hopefully you think it's anonymous. But obviously, if you're logging in with a name, then... But we do it with so many companies. So many companies know so much about us. So I'm thinking that's not perhaps such a big deal. But I think this is interesting in terms of if they get into monitoring. The other thing that they're trying to get into is sort of, which always is another trust part of it, is like automatic energy switching, where you just automatically get switched over to the cheapest provider once a year. And I'm a little bit iffy on that, because I think it can create a few problems both for the user and also the supplier, because the supplier wants the customer to stay long term. It doesn't want it to switch. And I think Money Supermarket's got a bit of juggling about to do on this, because it's like fund managers that churn portfolios. If customers think that, because we know that Money Supermarket only gets paid if people switch. If people think that they're switching too much, then perhaps there's a breakdown in trust there. Mm. And I think if they sort of limit it to say annual switching, that's probably, and that's what I understand what they're trying to do, so that it doesn't become constant moving about, because that's just confusing. Then yeah, there's perhaps something in it. So there's lots of things going on here. Most of it, I think, reasonably positive.
Yeah, which is, I mean, in this environment, it's nice to have a company which seems to be, holding its own and providing some reassurance to shareholders. Thanks very much, Phil.
Nice to be positive.
It isn't just oil in the Investors Chronicle this week. There is still the small matter of a global pandemic for investors to navigate, even if it has been off the front pages for a few hours. And of course, we've got a lot of ideas to help you do that. In this week's magazine, you'll also find a preview of next week's first quarter bank results, when we will see how they are coping with COVID. Alex Hamer has had a busy week. He's also looking at what commodities are doing the opposite of oil at the moment and rising. And an update from house builder Barratt Developments sheds light on how coronavirus is infecting the UK housing market. Meanwhile, Algie Hall and Simon Thompson are both on the hunt for small cap shares with lots of upside. And we have some results at last, including the much discussed on this podcast Fevertree drinks. And those results are testament to Phil Oakley's uncanny forecasting abilities. There's lots in the PF and fund section, including a selection of shockproof funds, which they'll be looking at on their podcast. In the meantime, thank you to all of our guests. Thank you, Megan. And thank you all for listening. Look out for the mag in the shops if you can get out. Drowning in oil, what the plunging oil price means for investors. Or if you're still stuck indoors, get online and subscribe, where you'll find lots of extra content that you won't find in the mag. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.